Hi, I'm Michael Beinhorn. Hope you're doing well. You're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
Let me introduce my guest. I'm speaking with producer Michael Beinhorn. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Michael, before we get into the album Super Unknown, tell me a little bit about your background. Share with us, like, what would you consider your big break that got you into production?
I suppose that would have been when I co-produced and co-wrote a song called Rocket for Herbie Hancock in 1983.
Familiar.
We wound up doing an entire record with him, and that was the big song off that record, and I guess a lot of people liked it because it did extremely well, and it just kind of kickstarted my career. I was working with another individual at the time as a production team, and we dissolved that not long after, so I was kind of on my own for a long time. And then about 4 years later, I got introduced to a relatively unknown band in Los Angeles called the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And from there, things started to take off.
And now that's a much different type of music than what you were doing with Herbie Hancock. I assume you're a musician of some note. Is what's your key instrument?
That's very kind of you to say. However, I don't really fancy myself as being much of a player. I do dabble in keys. I think what I'm most proficient in, really, in terms of musical instruments, is a synthesizer.
Okay.
As a programmer.
Now I'm calling you from St. Paul, Minnesota. One of our produced a record that's pretty big from one of our local bands here, Soul Asylum.
Oh, yeah.
Grave Dancers Union. Any fun anecdotes you can share quickly about working with those guys?
There were so many of them.
maybe I'll have to have you back on.
I've got a 2.5-year-old child, so my recall is running at half speed these days.
Oh, no problem.
We've
been there.
It was a great record to make. I mean, it was wonderful. I mean, Dave is a terrific songwriter. I mean, he had pretty much all the music ready to go when we started working, and it really came out great. I was very happy with it, and I think they were too.
And then jumping ahead then to the record we're going to talk about today, Super Unknown from Soundgarden. How did you get pulled into that? At that point, they've been working with Terry Date for the most part.
That's correct, yeah. They've been working with Terry Date, and I think they just wanted to try something new. And I was speaking to a gentleman who was managing me at the time, and he said, you know, you should really go for this next Soundgarden record. And I was like, oh. And the funnier thing about it was, it's like, I think I've heard a couple of records of theirs, maybe one. And, you know, he said one thing. It looks like they've already got a producer for the project, although it hasn't been officially, it hasn't been officially declared any place, you know. And I was like,
do you know who?
Why should I? I think it was going to be Rick Rubin.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, well, why should I bother if they already have someone? He's like, look, you should just go try it anyway. Just do it and see what happens. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. And I went up there, and somehow I'm still not sure how it worked. I was able to beguile them into into hiring me to produce the record. The only caveat was that we had to we actually had to go into a studio and work on a couple of songs just to see how it would feel, which was kind of an odd. It was sort of an odd request under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Because, well, I mean, there were two random songs. They didn't have anything to do with the record we were about to make. And the record we were going to make would have been under much different conditions. But I was like, okay, fine, whatever it takes. This is exciting. I want to do it. So, yeah, let's go for it.
What were the two songs?
The songs are called... No Attention and She Likes Surprises.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they wound up on like a vinyl version of the record, or you know, some kind of additions to the album somewhere along the line.
Yeah, they did that but deluxe whole monster box out of this record. So
exactly, yeah.
Well, as a producer, like you know that. I've talked to a handful of them, and they kind of approach things a little differently. For you, what do you feel your job is as a producer once you're basically attached to a project?
Well, you know, it's variable. You know, I try and help the artist in all the areas that I feel. And I have to work at this from a very kind of from an innate kind of instinct based place where I feel that they might be lacking, mm-hmm. and to try and torque up their strengths as much as I can so that they make the best possible record that they can make. I mean, I think by taking care of those two positions, you've pretty much covered the entire range of what the artist is going to need over the course of a recording project.
Would you by chance recall what you felt their strengths were and what you thought they needed to improve?
Well, yeah. I think one of the most amazing things about them was just the overall vibe that they projected as a band together. I mean, they were incredibly powerful personalities, and I think that comes through in all their work. You know, it's kind of hard to argue that Chris was one of the greatest rock singers who ever lived.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a core to them that I just felt they'd never really touched. There was an essence to them that I felt that they'd never really gotten to. And while I have absolutely nothing bad to say about any of the predecessors to the record that we did,
mm-hmm.
I did feel that there was a lot of like fat, you know, that there were these jams that went on for a while. And to me, that was stuff that if you wanted to see a band live, you could go see them do that. You know, if you're going to make a record, like when you listen to a jam over and over again, it's not a jam anymore because you start going off. Yeah. The
So I've never heard that before. That's perfectly stated.
Well, what was meant as an what would have been, you know, meant as an improvised thing becomes mm-hmm. part. It becomes a structural construct after a while. It becomes something, you know, because you start remembering things, and it's not the spontaneity begins to kind of melt away. And after a while, you even become your brain is expecting to hear the improv done exactly the way it is. And if the band performs the song live and they don't play it exactly the same way, there's going to be something in your brain that's a little disappointed by that. I'm not interested in capturing those aspects, you know, at least from the perspective of an actual performance that are improvised. The nuances, however, of a performance that pertain directly to an actual structure, like a vocal performance, for mm-hmm. example, that has and that's part of what I have to do as a producer, is listen to all the nuances and all the subtleties and select, or at least be an arbiter, I guess, in the selection process of what finally gets picked and used on the on the final recording that everyone hears. It felt to me like there was a deeper level to this band in terms of structures, in terms of songwriting, in terms of composition, in terms of creating ideas that had a real resonance to them in terms of structural elements. And to me, I felt that it was really important to bring that out while not losing any of the rawness and the power, and in fact, amplifying that, like finding really subtle aspects of what I felt made the band so vital and so exciting. You know, as an example, I noticed when I listened to Chris sing that his voice was so powerful that there was always a little expulsion of air at the end of some of his lines. You could hear him pushing out from his stomach, like that, right at the end. And to me, that was so sexy. I was listening to other records he did, and you couldn't really make it out. Like, you had to listen for it. And I was like, why in God's name did the people who recorded this guy, why didn't they, like, try and amplify that in some way or make it a little bit more evident? Because there's something so raw and sensual about that. Like, why you wouldn't want to make that be kind of a little bit more apparent? Because it's not, you know, it's not something that you're immediately going to notice, but it's something that you hear and it becomes part of the entire presentation. You know, it's things like that were very important to me. Like I wanted to focus on a lot of details on the record.
Well, I definitely think you delivered on that.
Thank you.
This is really early in digital recording, right? So I'm assuming this is all done on tape.
Yeah, that's correct.
You know, I was talking to the engineer on Siamese Dream, and he talked about how they did drum takes, and it just blew my mind. Did you record like four or five takes of one drum track and then splice up the tape physically and put together one, or would you take one clean cut?
It varies. You know, it depends who the drummer is. I mean,
record, I'm asking, I guess.
On Super Unknown, I'm pretty sure that we didn't do any edits.
Okay.
I didn't think. But I mean, Matt is, well, I mean, I wouldn't want to have that be a reflection of anyone else. Certainly not Jimmy Chamberlain, who's a phenomenal drummer, you know, but Matt didn't really need to do any edits. Like the only area where I found Matt was like, you know, where, you know, you would basically say this take is better than that take, was that some of them didn't seem as energetic.
Okay.
That was kind of the basis on which I was judging the drum takes. And when he hit it, it was so incredibly obvious that, you know, everyone who was in the control room would look at each other and go like, oh yeah, that is definitely the one.
Now, and I read in preparing for this that Adam Casper, who worked with you as an engineer on this record, he was actually the house engineer at Bad Animal Studio. Is that commonplace that you just kind of work with the house engineer, or do producers like yourself were you kind of forced to work with him? I guess is kind of where I'm going to, was it just not that big a deal? I'm not really phrasing that well.
Adam was the assistant on the record. He wasn't the engineer.
Okay.
Yeah. The engineer on that record was a guy named Jason Corsaro.
That's someone you would have brought in?
I brought him in. Yeah.
Okay.
I brought him in. No, Adam actually, the reason that Adam worked on that record was that Adam actually petitioned to do it. It was wonderful. Like he sent me a CV, and no one had ever done anything like that before. And I was like, if this guy is going to have the balls to do something like that, he is definitely the person that I want on this project.
Okay.
You know, so I was extremely grateful to have someone who was that, you know, who had that kind of nerve to say, like, this is what I'm going to do to get on this project. I want to do it so badly. You know, I was really impressed by that.
Well, that makes a whole lot more sense to me, I guess. It just stuck out that I was reading a Spin magazine interview, and it really didn't break it down like you did, of course. I'm also not breaking news that you and the band clashed a bit during the recording of this. My impression,
that's putting it mildly.
Yeah. All right, well, I'd love to get into some of that stuff. I'm not trying to dig up wounds or anything like that. I do find it interesting, though.
No, man. It really, ask away. It doesn't bother
okay.
me at all.
My impression was it wasn't like, because sometimes you work with a band and one member is really the more difficult one. It seems like Soundgarden almost had a circling the wagons kind of mentality when it came to working with you. Is that accurate? Did I pick up that vibe right?
That's actually pretty good. I never really thought about it that way. As far as the circling the wagons mentality, it was interesting because I think that they were expecting that we were going to make a different record than the record that we actually made.
How would you explain that?
Well, I realized after I got the gig that they hadn't really been preparing to make sort of like the record of their lives.
Mm.
What they wanted to do was make a record relatively quickly and just get back on the road and start touring again.
That kind of surprises me.
Well, it surprised me too. And it seemed kind of odd because like the entire world was sort of looking at Soundgarden going like, okay, this is going to be the next band that hits. Like these guys are going to be huge. All they have to do is make the right record. And see, I came into the project with that understanding. I was like, okay, this is my job. I have this responsibility to deliver this for this artist. So this is what I'm prepared to do here to help this artist make the record of their lives, basically. And I realized, you know, not long after that we weren't all exactly on the same page. And when I got demos for the record, actually, I listened to this cassette because it was only one and there were about 11 songs on it. And maybe four of them were songs that we wound up recording. The rest of it was just kind of like, you know, and I had to tell them, you guys, like, honestly, I think we need to do some more writing before we go into a recording studio and start tracking this. And, you know, that wasn't good footing for me to kind of step off on. And it didn't put me in the best position with the band at that point. They weren't very happy to hear that. I mean, they went along with it, which I was really grateful, but, it was tough. Like they didn't want to get into the experimentation part of it.
Really?
I mean, it wasn't even really experimentation. I had a very specific idea of what I wanted this record to sound like. I wanted it to be a combination of elements that were extremely detail oriented, but were extremely raw, you know, dirty and punchy. I was listening to a lot of electronic music. And I wanted to do something that just kind of cut really against the grain of the type of rock music that people were making then, especially the type of music that people were making coming out of Seattle, because there was a real movement at that point, as you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel that this record should be part of that. I felt like it could be something more than that, something that you wouldn't necessarily align with a fashion statement like grunge.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're basing this interview on Rolling Stone's greatest grunge record, so I guess I wasn't able to eclipse that entirely.
I actually would disagree with you on that. If you care to know, I'm not a huge fan of Rolling Stone. I went with this list because, despite that not my favorite cup of tea, they're credible to a certain extent, but also it just kind of keeps me on a path where I'm not like dictating, you know, I'm just going to hammer through them. We're going to do an honest breakdown of each one and kind of celebrate grunge as a whole. And I think Soundgarden definitely belongs in that conversation. This album is next level, in my opinion. And I don't think I'm the only person to tell you that. But
well, thanks. but I mean, that's going a long way to trying to answer your question and say, yeah, it was a hard record to make. And there was a lot of headbutting going on. I mean, there was definitely a lot of arguing. And I mean, I have to give the band a lot of credit, though. They hung with it, even though they disagreed with a lot of the aesthetic choices that were made.
Do you have any we can laugh about it now type arguments you'd like to share?
Let me think.
I'm hitting you out of the blue on it, so I get it. But
yeah, no, I'm doing the best. I'm doing the best I can. No, I mean.
Well, I read a story about you breaking a door in the studio. Is that?
Oh shit! Wow. Yeah, that's really funny. But that had nothing to do with the band. I had the worst migraine of my life. I had the worst migraine of my life, and it was, and I was in so much pain that I shoved this airlock, like this enormous door, and I mean, I'm not particularly large, but I actually busted it right off its hinges. To this day, I'm not sure how I did it, but yeah, no, that had nothing to do with being angry at anyone.
That's too bad.
just had it. Yeah, I guess it was a really expensive door, too. It really sucked. Yeah, I mean, you get a migraine on top of that, an $1,800 bill for a door.
Well, yeah, those studio doors tend to be built pretty solid for the sound reason, but...
Yeah, no, they worked really well. wow, I'm surprised that you... Thanks for throwing that one at me. It set me on my toes. as far as we can laugh about it, I don't think those guys ever really forgave me for the fights that we got or the disagreements that we had.
Aww.
No, actually, I think I got an apology from one of them at the end of the record.
Yeah.
you know, but it's all water under the bridge at this
sure.
point. You know, it had to be that way. I don't begrudge them for how they felt about it. I mean, this is definitely new territory for all of us to go into. And, you know, I mean, I'm just glad that I felt so sure about the direction that we were headed. And also the fact that, some of the material on most of the record is just undeniable. Yeah, the whole thing. The whole record. It's a wonderful piece of work. And
yeah.
To this day, I'm incredibly proud to have been associated with it, and I feel really fortunate about that. I'm very grateful, and I love those guys for giving me the opportunity to work with them.
But conflict can actually be an asset, you know, when you're dealing with creating something. You know what I mean? Passion can push somebody to a limit that they might not go with. You know what I mean?
Well, it's that, but it also can it can give a person the ability to voice why they feel strongly about something.
Ooh, that's well said.
Well, it's interesting because if you have so much conviction about something and someone challenges you in a way where they feel for one reason that they're right about something, but you know that you're right, you're able, the conflict gives you the ability to be able to express to them why it is that you feel that things need to go the direction that you feel that they need to go in. And if you're able to convince them, or at least to arrive at some sort of compromise where both sides are kind of accommodated, the end result can be absolutely stupendous. And in this case, it often was.
Is it true that they would sing Kumbaya to you at certain points to kind of be dicks or you know, to fuck with you, I guess is a better way to put it?
I don't remember that.
Okay. I found that in Kim Thayil said that in a different interview, but
I remember a bunch of other things. I mean, we used to mess with each other very much. Well, I actually have some recordings of me just being absolutely horrible to Kim. You know, but Kim is not someone who takes that kind of stuff lightly. He'll give you as good as he gets.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We went through the ringer on that one.
I found some kind of conflicting information, so maybe you can help answer this. It sounds like this record took a while to make, not surprisingly. But how long do you recall?
Yeah. From the time that we started recording, it was about 3.5 months.
Okay.
They had about a 3-week tour that they did with Neil Young. So we had to stop when they did that. And before that, it was about 2 months of pre-production to assemble all the songs and get the songs prepped and ready to be recorded.
Was the pre-production done in Seattle as well?
Well, I was living in Connecticut, so I would go back and forth. But for the most part, it was them working on music in Seattle and sending me okay. music to listen to.
Once recording started, did you stay in Seattle then, or?
Yeah, I was there for the duration, except for the tour that they did.
Paint the picture then. You're just staying at a hotel. You shack up with Cornell.
Or... No, it was nothing like that. They put me up in corporate apartments.
Okay.
In downtown Seattle, I think I was like a couple of blocks away from the Pike Market and stuff.
So would that have been like your first real experience spending time in Seattle? That's a little off base, but just asking.
No, it's okay. I'd been there. No, I'd made a record there before. It was before. So I'd spent some time there.
You know, I have a general question for you as a producer. Now, you mentioned like they would send you demos and stuff. When a band that you're going to work with sends you demos, do you prefer them to be kind of stripped down as they can be? I've heard someone say that sometimes, I can't remember the word it was, but basically overproduced. Like they worked a little too hard to slicken up the demo, and it makes you less interested. It's almost like they, if it's bare bones, it's easier for the producer to kind of come up with his own vision for the song. Is that how you feel?
I think it like so many other things, it's variable. It's really kind of down to who the artist is, what the record's going to be like, you know, what the artist's interpretation or intent for the record happens to be. You know, I mean, in the case of this band, they were all really good at organizing their ideas. Matt and Chris in particular were able to provide, you know, pretty finished pieces of work. And with Chris, you had someone who basically could play every instrument. Like if he gave me a demo, he played all the instruments on it. He wrote all the parts. Obviously he sang the song.
Yeah.
He wrote the melodies. He wrote the lyrics. I mean, he basically covered every bass from soup to nuts. So there wouldn't have been anything that I would say to Chris, you know, I would have listened to on one of Chris's demos and gone like, he went too far. You know, he did exactly what needed to be done on all of them. And, I felt like with this record really wasn't, it wasn't about me kind of having trying to get my licks in, so to speak. Like it was about, it really felt more about trying to assemble the right, I guess, cadre, if you will, of material, to present, you know, to make the right presentation and then have the, and then worry about the aesthetics. Like once we had a song like Black Hole Sun in place, to me, like, in many ways, that really defined what this record was going to become. I mean, that's hearing that song jump-started me on so many different levels in terms of what we could do and how far we could go and what kind, you know, how far I would be able to go creatively in helping forge a sound for it. So I wouldn't have put those any kind of constraints on them in terms of, you know, how they wanted to deliver demos for, you know, for the record.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know what kind of budget they had for Superunknown? I assume you're involved in that.
It was pretty good. I mean, it was around, I think it was like $400,000.
Okay. How much of that did you take?
Not a whole lot.
I kid.
Not a whole lot.
Now I read that
I made up for it in the back end.
Okay, yeah, sure. The thing that was a wildly successful record. I sure hope the fruits were spread around, but
it worked out just fine. There's no possible way I could complain.
That's good to hear. I read that you recorded the songs one at a time. Is that accurate?
We recorded them four at a time.
Okay.
They decided that they wanted to make the record that way. They wanted to do
that was their decision.
Songs in batches. That was their decision. They wanted to do songs in batches of four. It was just a, you know, it was just a thing they wanted to do, and I was like, okay, that's great.
Well, one thing that's pretty important to almost any rock record, especially, you know, recorded before digital, is kind of a cohesive, at least, drum sound. I think you can kind of catch up with all the other stuff and even bring in different elements and not lose it. But so as geeky as this might be, I do find it interesting. Would you have left just basically the drum set fully mic'd, the board set the way it is, or, you know what I mean? So basically you do the four songs, you don't play drums again and tell the next batch, or would you reset up and reconfigure every time?
Well, you know, it's interesting because for the record, we had two sets. We had two separate sets, and you can hear there's a difference in drum sound from song to song. Like some of them are a little bit washier than others, which is not my preference, by the way. I don't like roomy, washy drums, but they insisted. And that's, you know, that's obviously not an argument that's worth having. And in the end, I'm glad that Matt stuck to his guns on that one, because I feel like, I mean, the record sounds the way it sounds. It's not like you can really argue with that.
Right.
But we had two completely different setups for some of the songs. And, you know, he'd basically go to one and then the other, depending on how he felt or, you know, what he felt the song called for. I mean, we would move stuff around from session to session. Like when we get done with a batch of four, we'd come back to the next batch and, you know, we might want to change something here or there. I was less interested in the more roomy kit. You know, it had less mics. I love detail, as I suppose I've probably implied already.
Sure.
And I like pinpointing certain aspects of certain instrument sounds. And, I was just constantly tinkering with the drum sound on the more mic'd up kit. As time went by, you would just, I don't know if you'd use the word refine, but, you know, I'd just be tweaking stuff constantly, trying to hone it more.
It still sounds cohesive from beginning to end, though. So that's pretty impressive to hear. But it sounds like you did less tweaking as it went, as the record got deeper. Or
no, I did more. But the things that add the cohesion are the drummer. Is the drummer in the room that we were in? We were in the same room.
Okay.
You know, we didn't move the drums from their location points in the rooms, in the room. And, you know, it's the same guy playing drums. I mean, Matt is the kind of drummer where you put him up on 10 different drum kits and he'll make them all sound pretty much the same.
Okay.
Because he has a sound. He is a very recognizable drummer in every sense of the word. There's some musicians have that capability to take any instrument that they play and make it sound like them. There's going to be a consistency. I know a bunch of guitarists who can do this.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter what instrument they're playing through, what amplifier they're playing through. No matter what you do, there's still going to be an element of them.
What about guitar tones then? Who is more interested in kind of, because there's a lot of really, there's a lot of color to the guitar tones from song to song on this record. Who was more involved in that? Like, I really want to try to mess with this a little bit. Would it be Chris or Kim or
me?
Me, baby.
No, I got to be honest. I was the person who wanted to play with guitar tones. Like Chris, I remember we went on a buying. Well, it didn't really wind up being much of a spree. But we went to a local music store to pick up some gear for the record.
Okay.
I don't know why I kind of urged him to do this, but we wound up getting him a Marshall, like a JMP 70s Fawn half stack with a slant cab. It was a 50 watt. And that was half of the guitar sound for the record. We never deviated from this rig. And he had a really nice assortment of guitars. I think the other one we got him, the one we got him there was like a jazz master. Meanwhile, Kim, he couldn't care less. Okay. He had these like he had these PVs. This PV like
VTMs.
120 or something like that.
The VTM 120. Huh? The VTM 120.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I'm sorry. Some PV stuff actually does sound good. Like they make they make an amp called the Decade, which is a tiny little guitar amplifier. Yeah. And it's one of my favorite amplifiers. It's great. You know, I think you can get one of these things for like $50.
Okay.
And it's a great amp. I mean, you don't want to use it for everything, but it's...
They're the bass rig and PA equipment, especially at that time.
Yeah. Well, whatever the case, this amplifier did not sound good. It certainly didn't stack up against what Chris had. And it also didn't deliver the kinds of tone. Like, it sounded really, really, like, no personality at all. Even a little bit metally.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I'm
you know,
quite familiar with that amp.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope I'm not insulting you.
Not at all. You haven't said nothing I wouldn't echo, especially the metal part. Okay. It is more of a metal amp. But, you know, PV at the time was kind of chasing it and trying to make their own name in the guitar amp game. So I don't recall anybody else playing them, but Kim is why it kind of stands out. But
yeah, and it wasn't the right guitar sound for the record. I didn't want to make a metal record either. I didn't want to make something that you could typify by genre. I wanted to make something that you could typify by emotion, by hearing it. It would jar you in a certain way.
Now, if you're starting out as a band, it was an affordable amp that would be loud and reliable for you. Once you're at this level of Soundgarden, you probably want to move on to something else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, we kind of like dug around and dug around. And finally, I matched that, the Marshall half stack rig with a, believe it or not, a Mesa Boogie dual rectifier. Mm. With a Mesa cab, a straight cab, and I'm not a fan of the dual rectifier on its own, but for some reason when I put it together with that Marshall, it just did something wonderful. It just sounded great, and that was the basis of all the guitar sounds on the record. That rig right there, we plugged everything into it, and I would just go out there and tweak until I felt that I had a sound that I liked, you know, and we'd go back in and record it. And that was that's how all the guitar sounds were done. You know, Chris had a solid collection of guitars. He had that Jazzmaster. Of course, he had those amazing Gretsch guitars. He had that, you know, the single and the double cutaway, which are, I mean, I would say that they're probably the best examples of those guitars I've ever heard in my life. They're wonderful guitars.
Well, you mentioned Black Hole Sun. There's a lot of like kind of layered effects on some of that stuff. But what about like, let's say, Super Unknown, the opening riff there? To me, that's a very nasally and dirty, but at the same time, very smooth. That's more than just a guitar cable and head thing going on there, right?
No.
Come on.
It really isn't. Huh. It really isn't. I'm telling you. I mean, there was so much serendipity in the making of this record.
Oh, I love that word.
As much as we fought, as much, you know, and there were, you know, getting guitar sounds, especially with Kim. Actually, it took like days, literally days, to get a guitar sound. It was terrible. It was really, really hard to do. And it's not because Kim's a bad guitarist. Quite the opposite. Just, you know. He didn't want to sit there and keep trying to get a tone, and like, you know, I got frustrated, he got frustrated. It was, you know, it was unpleasant. But like, so much magic through all the tension, so much magic happened. I mean, you have moments like that. I'll tell you something, man. When we were recording that, and I think I was the only person throughout the making of the record that was excited about it at all. At the end of the night, and Adam was. I know that Adam was very excited about it. I think he was really into it. Adam was kind of like, he was sort of my, in hindsight, he was kind of like my rock.
Nice.
Because he was the only person who was really kind of like going like, wow, this is going to be great. everyone else was like, meh, you know. But at the end of the night, I would sit down and listen to what we'd done. And I'd find myself like listening to the same song like 5-6 times in a row. I keep playing it over and over again. I was like, Jesus Christ, this is incredible.
So that's normal.
Yeah. It's normal if you're enjoying what you're doing.
Right.
You know, if you're not, like, you probably don't even want to, you know, do a, you know, a recap of the day's work. But I would be sitting there, like, people would be like, look, I got to get out of here. And I'd be like, go. I'm listening to this again. I love this. It's amazing.
Right on.
You know, it was really funny, actually, because while we were making the record, after we'd done, like, the first batch, the product manager from A&M, this guy Jim Guarino, who later on managed Chris and became a very, very successful manager, he came to the studio to listen to what we were doing. And, you know, we had the first batch of 4 songs, one of which was Spoon Man, which honestly I wasn't a fan of at the time.
Yeah, me either.
It's funny. I just didn't care for it.
It doesn't, you know, click with me. And I was a big fan.
Yeah. You know, he came, he sat down, he listened to the 4 songs, and he got up, he said thanks, and he left. And I was like, what the fuck? I was so mad. I was like, you just walked out of the room listening. This is going to be the most important rock record you guys are going to put out at least this year. Mm. And that's your attitude?
Yeah.
You know? And it was hysterical. Like 3 or 4 months after the record came out, he actually called me up and he said, I'm so, so sorry about that.
Oh, did you say it to him when he walked out? Or was like,
No, I didn't say it
okay,
to him.
Okay.
I stood there in a state of shock. I mean, he knew what happened. He knew he just bailed on us, you know, and didn't say, hey, it's great, you know, great work. He was just like, cool, thanks.
Wow. Okay.
You know, he realized that the response had been somewhat withering, but it was all fine. I was like, look, it's good. You know, the record's is doing great. It's going to be wonderful for everybody. I'm happy that you're happy with it.
What was your, how much experience had you had recording spoon solos before that?
Now that's got to be the trick question of questions.
At least you paused for a second and then started laughing. That had to be weird though, huh? What was it? I really actually want to know, how do you record a guy playing? I mean he's just hitting spoons together on his legs and stuff, right?
It's a little more than that. I've never really experienced anything like that before.
I didn't expect that kind of answer.
this guy's a very unusual person.
Of course, he's a homeless spoon man.
It wasn't just spoons. It wasn't just spoons. He comes in. He had like a bedroll or something like that, like full of metal implements and stuff like that. And he just unrolled it.
So he's like kind of, so he's rolling this thing out.
Yeah, he's rolling it out.
Okay.
And we just put up a pair of U67s that were in kind of like a, you know, a relatively tight ambient position so that we would get a little bit of the room, but mainly him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because obviously you can't have something that's really too directional. So you've got to, you know...
That's a good point.
I mean, these are obviously
use a 57
like cardio.
On that.
What's that?
You can't use a 57.
No. Yeah, we would be. Let's try and mic each spoon individually. yeah. No, we had to have something sensitive that we could move. That, you know, where we could capture the area that he was in, rather than like getting too, you know, spot mic ear specific, because you're anticipating that there's going to be some moving around, but we had no idea what we were in for, you know, because he said, you're going to want to get it. You're going to have a video camera around for this. And the minute the song started rolling, he went crazy. I mean, he was smacking himself all over his body with these things. And it wasn't just spoons. It was like bits of metal. He just like you know, and then he'd reach down and grab something else, and he'd be bashing himself in the head. It was, and as you can imagine, after a certain point, there was blood flying everywhere.
What?
I'm not making this up, man. Wait,
so it,
and there's a video
like through,
of it
like through his
too.
Shirt or
what's that?
Like through his clothes or?
He was shirtless.
Oh, okay.
He was shirtless. It was, you know, I don't think any of us really ever got over that day. it was a lot to bear witness to.
Oh my Lord! Now, how long did he play? Because the solo was not that long.
Well, he did about, I'm gonna say like five passes, six passes, maybe. Okay. He played through the whole song. It's not just. It's not just the solo section.
Is it? Wait a second. Are you saying that that's actually in the song all the way through?
Yeah, I mean, there's bits of it here and there.
Oh, like okay, okay.
Write it in here and there, but he played the whole way through each time. I mean, he was bashing his body with these spoons and bits of metal through, you know, like good five, six times, I'd say.
Did you ever find out if you liked the song or not?
I don't think it mattered.
Okay.
He was a very interesting character.
Wow. I guess I didn't really expect it to be quite as dramatic, but.
Well, there you go. Ask the right question, you get the right answer.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the songs. Besides that, Black Hole Sun. You mentioned that kind of shaped the record when you hit that. Now, as you're recording that. Kind of, I mean, there's a lot going on in that song. I mean, was the demo? It couldn't have been that produced, right? There was a lot of stuff that was added. Kind of, I guess what I'm asking is, as you got the basis of the song down, were there like, hey, let's try this, let's try this, and these kind of things that just kept building onto it?
Nope.
Really?
I would like to say that I did some kind of genius move. To add a certain kind of spice to the song, but I can't and I won't.
Sure.
What I can say is that without me, that song wouldn't exist, but that's a whole different story.
Well, let's hear that.
I do want to say that everything about that song in terms of parts, ideas, structure, well, I mean, I made one little tweak in the song and that's it.
Okay.
That was Chris's genius and everything that the guys could bring to the table. You know, like that drum fill right before the last chorus, which is just absolutely out of this world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Chris, that came out of, that just fell out of him, that whole thing, all the guitar parts, all the background vocal parts. I remember when I first heard the cassette tape from that, I felt like I was on drugs. It was incredible. It was absolutely beautiful. And the way the song came about is that I'd received a batch of about, I was getting demos fairly regularly from Chris, and you know, some of them were good, but for the most part, they were kind of throwaway-ish. And I was beginning to detect a bit of a pattern. I mean, we had, I'd say maybe 60 to 70% of the record, but we were still missing like this really epic, epic song. And I was like, I've got to talk to this guy because we're about to go down a really bad pathway. And if I don't say something, because I'd received this batch of 11 songs and not one of them. I mean, I listened to them like not too long ago and they were, you know, they're pretty good. I mean, Chris wrote them, he sang on them and, you know, but they still didn't feel like they were up to the standard of the record that we were going to make, you know, and that's when I knew I had to have a conversation with him and I spoke with him and I wanted to kind of get into his head a little bit and understand what was motivating him to write these kind of songs. And eventually I began to realize that he was trying to please his audience. Like he was trying to write songs that he felt would be appropriate for a Soundgarden fan.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, doing something like that can be extremely dangerous because you don't really know who it is that these people are. And I explain this to them. It's like, you can't, you know, you haven't, you're talking about trying to please people whose experiences aren't yours. You know, they like your music because it's you, not because you're trying to please them, you know, not because you're trying to do something that makes, you know, that gives them a certain sense of, I guess, identification with what you're doing.
Sure.
You know, they connect with you because you're you, because your expression is unique, you know.
And you're not talking about Kiss fans, by the way.
No. No, definitely not.
We all know them.
Yeah,
just kidding.
Exactly.
Just kidding.
I know. Well, Kim's a big Kiss fan, so.
Nice. I would have picked the opposite.
Yeah, he loves Kiss. Ah. He's a big Kiss. At least he... He loves Kiss when we were working together. So, but
anyway,
I asked Chris, you know, because we were talking about doing something that would be more of an expression of him, you know, and I was saying to him, look, you know, go back to, you know, go inside, like connect with yourself, make music, write songs that really come from you. And, you know, I was like, what are you listening to right now? Like, what do you love? What music do you love? And he said, the Beatles and Cream. And I was like, okay, wow. Write a song that sounds like the Beatles and Cream, you know? And he was like, well, what if it doesn't sound like Soundgarden? And I said, don't worry if it doesn't sound like Soundgarden. When you guys get together and play the song, it will be Soundgarden because you guys are Soundgarden.
Yeah.
It's really simple, you know? And he was like, okay, I got it. I was like, yeah, don't worry about it, man. Just roll with this. It's going to be great. And so 2.5-3 weeks after the conversation, he sends me this cassette tape. It's got 4 songs on it. The first song was Fell on Black Days. The minute I heard it, I was like, oh, yeah, okay. This is really good, yeah. You know. And it's such a great song.
Yeah.
The next song was a song that – he had Jerry Cantrell come in and play guitar on it. You know, we didn't use it. It was too bluesy, but it was still really good. The second was a song. The third was a song called Tighter and Tighter, which wound up on the record after the one that we did. And I was very sad about that because I actually liked that song very much. And I would have loved to have had it on Super Unknown anyway. And we actually began to record it, but the band didn't want to keep going with it. And the last song was Black Hole Sun. And from the very moment I started listening to it, I was like, oh my God, I don't know what this is. I've never heard anything like this before, but it is so good. And I just waited, as I often do, for the thing to fall apart. Because usually when people start out a song with a really great intro, it just kind of, it falls apart somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm always waiting for this point where the song is going to dissolve and I'm going to be like, okay, this is where my heavy lifting part comes in. I have to figure out how to make this thing work. And it never happened. That moment never came for me. I just kept listening to it, waiting for something to fall apart, and it didn't. And I wound up listening to the song 15 times in a row. And I was like, each time I listened to it, I was more into it and I was more captivated and engaged with it. And I called Chris up and I was like, you know something? You're a fucking genius.
Yeah.
I was like, you've written an amazing song. He's like, I told him he was a genius. He's like, really? Why? I was like, this song. And he's like, which one? And that was where I started to realize that he didn't even know what he had, you know? Mm. And I started talking to the rest of the guys in the
band. That's probably common with songwriters, I suppose.
Some know what they've got, and sometimes people are like, you know? And I called the rest of the guys in the band the next day, and I was like, do you believe this song? And they're like, which song? And I was like, that Black Hole Sun song that he wrote, of course. And they're all like, yeah. It's okay.
Wow.
You know, we'll see if we record it. And I was like, what? we can't be talking about the same song here. You got to be kidding me. The thing that I heard is amazing. And they're like, we'll see.
Yeah, there isn't a spot from beginning to end on that song where you start to lose interest. You know what I mean? It captivates you from beginning to end.
Well, yeah. And that's what a song should do.
Well, of course, you know, but you and I both know that that's not always the case, but it is interesting that Fell on Black Days was on that same demo, because I've always found them almost to be like sister songs on this record.
Well, there you go.
Well, hey, you mentioned earlier about Chris's singing and that kind of like sexy breath at the end there. Now, he definitely sounds like a guy who can really push it. You confirm that. Was there ever a time that, like, I don't know, I have a small amount of experience in this, so that's what piqued my curiosity. Was he too loud? Like, it would just be hard to give him a good mix so where he could hear, like, himself over the music and that kind of thing?
Well, we recorded his vocals in a way where I don't think that ever became an issue. I found that Chris really didn't enjoy having people in the studio with him when he worked.
Hmm.
So I decided to set him up in the control room and record his own vocals, because I realized that he was perfectly good at being able to record and produce his work on his own. He did it at home. And in that case, he shouldn't, there would be no reason in the world why he shouldn't be able to do it in a recording studio. So we brought him in. I showed him how to operate the tape machine, which channels to use, which ones to stay away from, and then we set him up with the mic. We didn't use headphones for most of that. We actually ran a pair of monitors out of phase and aimed them at the back of the microphone, so the pickup, the back in cardioid of the microphone, that rejects everything that goes to the back of the microphone. So the bleed was actually less than what he was getting when he listened through headphones.
Oh, but he would still wear headphones? No headphones.
No, he didn't have to wear headphones. No, he was just listening out of phase, which can be difficult in
that
some cases.
That is amazing.
But he was, that's how he did most of the vocals.
Wow.
And I remember the first day he did that, actually, never done it before. And I just say to him, look, have at it. Here's, eight channels, six channels, whatever. Like, just record as many vocals as you want. When you're done, come up and get me. I'll come down, and I'll listen to him and comp him. And I remember he came running into the lounge about a half hour into doing vocals, and he was like, this is incredible. I'm never recording any other way again. because he was able to just be himself in the studio and not worry about what other people were saying about him, because he was pretty, he was pretty uncomfortable.
Let me ask you this. What about sequencing? Were you involved in that at all?
Yep.
So,
yes, I was.
So we're in the kind of the heyday where CD is the dominant format. Do you sequence different going into it with that mind as opposed to a side A and B?
I never did.
So you looked at it as like a first half and a second half.
Pretty much, I like the feel of that for whatever reason, it just kind of, I like the flow, but I also thought of it as like a concert, like what are the peaks,
okay.
What are the points where you're kind of like hanging back to give people like a little bit of
getting
space.
Getting a t-shirt. Yeah,
exactly.
Run in the bathroom.
Go have a piss or something like that.
I would have taken a leak during Spoon Man.
All right, yeah. Well, it sounds like it.
It sounds like you and I are on the same page with Spoon Man.
I've come to appreciate it more over time. I mean, besides, it's like, it's an important part of my life now. So, how am I going to, how am I going to kick it to the curb?
It was a huge song. There's no denying it.
It was. And people love it to this day. So
yeah.
I'm not going to say, I will not say anything disparaging about it at all.
I will.
Okay, you can.
They can take a shot at me.
That's okay.
I'm well aware that this is not a popular opinion. I have plenty of friends who, what are you talking about?
It's all right with me, man. It's all right.
Well, how about, on the sequencing of this, then any insight there as to like anything that slid around, any discussions as like were there any debates like, no, this needs to be moved at all? Or Spoon Man is the opening single and it's the eighth track on the album. That's a little rare.
Yeah, but it felt like the right place to put it. You know, the thing is that you didn't, back in those days, you didn't really have to concern yourself with trying to front load anything. I think people do that now because they're really concerned with trying with basically like shooting their wad as quickly as possible in case the record doesn't do well.
That's a different era now.
Yeah, you just try and put all your strongest material to the front and just hope people like it. Like with a record like Supranown or even Grave Dancers Union, like you know, knowing that you have music that's that good, you don't need to put it anywhere near the front if you don't want to. You can just play around with that. I mean, to put Black Hole Sun as an example or Spoon Man at the front of that record would have been, in my opinion, one of the dumbest things that you could do. You know, you're also those being some of the most popular songs, and you know, obviously so. You would have essentially spoiled the entire record for anyone who would actually want to sit around and play the record.
Oh, that's a great
and arrive
point.
At those songs organically.
Yeah.
You know? You know, so that would have really taken a lot of enjoyment out of people really getting into the record, which fortunately many people do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people constantly talk to me about songs that they love that are, you know, that were nowhere near being singles. You know, like 4th of July, which funnily enough is a song the only song on the record that I mixed. I just felt like sequencing that record, you really had to take into account a certain kind of flow and, you know, to make something that would, you know, that would interest people and would keep people wanting to hang on through the entire experience.
But I wasn't complaining about the sequence, just to be clear. This is damn near a perfect record to me.
Well, thanks.
I may have.
I didn't sound like you were complaining.
Okay, fair enough. I just want to make a clip. Maybe the listener would pick up on that. So, how did Brendan O'Brien get involved with being the mix? Was that the plan from the get-go? I know a lot of producers, they step away after a project this big, so maybe that was the plan all along?
Well, I wasn't going to mix it.
Okay.
You know, that was that was the bottom line. I mean, it's funny because like I've actually gone back to my rough mixes on the record, mm-hmm. and they actually it's a slightly different record, but I picked Brendan, partly because of his cachet at that point.
Sure,
the fact that he was, you know, that he was one of the leading rock mixers, and also I felt that his records had a certain excitement factor to them. You know, we tried a couple of other people, and I felt that their mixes fell short. Also I felt stylistically they didn't really match up with where this record was heading, or I mean what it already sounded like at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Scott Litt, who is terrific, really really good, but definitely was not appropriate for this record at all. You know, plus I felt we needed someone who would work on an SSL console. And that's what we tracked on anyway. And I wanted to have someone who had that kind of facility. And Brendan worked on an SSL. So that's the basis on which he got involved in the project.
Did you have any involvement on the 20th anniversary kind of deluxe super box edition of this thing?
Not a bit, no.
Wow, that's too bad.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I would like, you know, as a fan, I want all the people in the creative element to kind of come in. You know what I mean? you know, and I don't mean in the, well, to go back to an earlier part, a kumbaya moment. But the fact of the matter is, you know, you were a key role in it. And I just think there might be something there to add to it. But whatever. It doesn't,
yeah, no, I'm
doesn't
fine
have
with
to
it.
Be that.
No, that's fine.
Do you, you've worked on a lot of great records. Where does this stack up against, you know, I mean, so many albums. I mean, I got your list in front of me, but,
well, you know, I mean, it's a favorite, but you know, I got a lot of favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm really proud of a lot of the records I've done, you know.
Yeah.
This is a particularly important one in many respects. It's certainly the most popular record that I did. That's not inconsiderable, but you know, I think it was very important for me in many ways. It was definitely a pivotal record for me, and it really kind of helped define my career in a lot of ways. But you know, I think it's very easy in hindsight for a person to kind of take all kinds of credit.
Yeah.
For something. Besides, it's not as if you've got like Kim or Matt or Ben on the phone or even Adam to kind of say, hey, wait a minute, you know, and you know, yeah, but what about this? But one thing I will say is that beyond it being a group effort, which it absolutely was, there's also the element of serendipity and the element of the I guess the William Burroughs concept of the third mind, which is when two. Are you familiar? You know any of Burroughs?
Yeah, I know where you're going here, but this is pretty deep. I love it. Keep going.
Well, he wrote a book called The Third Mind, and I mean the general idea of the third mind is when it's almost like the magical child in like you know in magic, you know, through creative work. When two people collaborate, they create a third consciousness. And that's what this record is to me. It's not a body of songs. It's a consciousness. It's something that's actually a living entity to me. Like, it's like a child.
Do you have a favorite track?
You know? No. No, I don't.
How about a least favorite track?
I love the whole thing in its entirety. I really do. You know, it's very personal to me actually. Like it's a very special moment in time for me. And you know, it's been there for me over the years. You know, because I participated in its creation, and you know, I'm like a surrogate parent in a lot of ways to it.
I'll tell you this, a lot of people give, well, the song Half, let's just put it that way, gets a lot of shit. I like it. I enjoy it.
I insisted that song be on the record.
Oh, man. It's perfect right where it is, too. It's just kind of weird.
Ben fought me on that. Yeah. Ben fought me on it. He's like, there's no way this song goes on this record. I was like, Ben, come on.
It's his song, right?
This is brilliant. This is so good. It completely rounds the record out, and it adds an element to it that no other song is going to give. Please, you've got to let this song be on the record. It's so meaningful. It's so personal. And he finally gave in. I'm so glad he did, because it's a great piece of work, and it complements the record so beautifully.
I couldn't agree more. I think I probably wouldn't, you know, cherry pick it and put it on a playlist on an iPod or something like that. But when I'm listening
to
this,
the point.
Exactly. This needs to be heard in where it's at on this record, man.
It's as purposeful on that record as any other piece of music on that record. And no, I wouldn't necessarily put it on a playlist, but it adds something to the record that the record absolutely needs. Absolutely needs. And every time I hear it, it makes me feel good. I mean, that's Ben. That's his personality coming through on that song. And
nice.
He's a very, very important component in that band. I mean, without him, you just don't get Soundgarden. I mean, I didn't work with Hero. I know he was very important to the band too, but Ben just brought a whole different, you know, a whole different thing to it. And I loved him so much. I loved his personality. You know, he was wild and crazy, but at the same time, he's a very sensitive, like, you know, just big-hearted human being. And I love that song's on there. I'm just so grateful that he went for it.
Michael, this has been a fucking pleasure. Like I said, I was looking forward to this. I'm a fan of producers and the work they do, and anytime I get a chance to talk to somebody who worked on a record that meant so much to me, it is just something I get kind of giddy, and it almost takes me back to when I was younger and a little bit of a fanboy and stuff. So, and you could not have delivered better. So thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
And, is there anything you want to promote? Anything you got to pitch at all? Or
to pitch? Well, that's very kind of you. No, I mean, I apart from doing remote production and remote pre-production with people, which is something that I feel is incredibly important. And by the way, two things that are completely lacking from the way people make records these days.
Let's hear it.
Because no one takes the time anymore to really invest themselves in making a record. It's just kind of go into a studio, knock a bunch of songs out, get out fast, and hope that it'll, you know, that someone will actually like it. And the records that we're talking about, obviously, were aggressively gone over with fine-tooth combs.
Yep.
Before anyone even got close to a recording studio. I mean, my understanding is that Kurt, the songs that wound up on Nevermind, Kurt had been working on them for years. You know, I mean, that's talk about pre-production. Talk about like investing yourself in them. And these days, you know, artists aren't given any time or any chance to do any of that. So that's the kind of work that I'm doing now. I'm working with artists at every level of the spectrum because I don't feel that this kind of thing should be limited to the people who can afford it. I think it's something that should be available to people at every strata because there are plenty of talented people out there, even people who are probably never going to release a record or have like a large commercial release. I feel that this is the kind of thing that should be available for anybody because, you know, also because the process, the creative process is so unique and it's so special and it's revelatory for the people who really invest themselves in that. And something I feel that everyone who wants to be creative should be able to experience at one point in their lives.
That means so much to me. You have no idea. That if you'd even take the time to say something like that. I couldn't agree more. I wish I could give you a round of applause with 100 people behind me, but
thank you.
Michael, I really did enjoy this. I hope
you
did too.
Yes, I did. Absolutely. It's funny that it came out of the blue since I had you in a different day, but yeah. No problem either way.
It worked out. I'm sorry I blindsided you. I'm not sure what happened there, but anyway, thank you
Don't
so much.
Worry. It's
and,
probably me.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Do you need to get a drink or something like that? I just want to make sure you're okay.
You're very kind. Wait, you hear me getting a little scratchy?
Yeah, and it's okay. Your voice sounds great. Everything's coming through clear. I just if you need just a second, I don't mind.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think I'm okay. I think I'll make it. I'm gonna try.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.